At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
You guys ready? All right, let's do this.
Welcome to Scoop, where you get the scoop on this week's news. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News.
I feel like we could do a little, like, some sort of workout to this music. We could do, maybe that's our next thing, you guys. We could be on the treadmill. You know what this would work really good at? What were those classes with the stair step? You know, that you had like a stair, you had the riser. Am I sounding prehistoric? You know what I'm talking about, right? Where you can step up, step down, step up, step down. I did that class when I was studying abroad in Spain because it was a really good way to start learning the language, you know, like up, down, left, right. You know, you had to do it fast. So I think I also fell during one of those classes really bad. The whole class had to stop. One of my most embarrassing moments. So I figure let's start there today. I want you to feel good about the news. I want you to feel so good after Scoop. It's like you did a workout, right? That you feel like you accomplished something. That's what we want for you today. We had a lot of really big headlines that broke last week, Thursday, Friday, going into Saturday. And I don't know about you, but during summer, it's easier for me to tap in Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. But by Thursday, Friday, we're moving on to something else. So I saw these headlines cross. They're important. They're a little bit weighty. And they got a viral life of their own on social media. So what I want to do today is go over a lot of what you've basically seen over the last couple of days and add some clarity, a little foundation to some of these headlines. We got a lot of news from the Supreme Court. We got news from Congress. We got news, breaking news on a murder investigation. What could be described, at least from a media perspective, as a cold case in that it wasn't getting a lot more attention. It was a murder of a mother in Maryland, but they caught the guy. And there's an additional story to that. So we're going to go all through all of that for you today. If you have any questions or comments, we'd love to see you live. Our Scoop Insiders are joining us from all over the country. It's great to see you guys as always. Thank you. We have our audience on Instagram also joining us live today, which is really exciting. And what we're trying to do, we're trying to deliver news differently. And we've had a lot of roadblocks thrown in our way over the last couple of weeks. Just name it. Technology, we've requested to belong, you know, we've requested simple things like simple Instagram verification, things like this that we've been doing regularly and keep on getting denied. And, you know, it's really easy to get discouraged when you think, well, this stuff is working for everybody else. Why isn't it working for us? And I always have to step back and say, well, we're doing news totally different. We're doing news totally different. So if we're being pushed to do something that not everyone is doing, we need to look at that as an opportunity. So today is an opportunity to share what we're doing on Scoop, show folks what we're doing and how we're able to connect with our insiders. We are completely ad-free. There is a sale going on in our store. If you go to smarternews.com and you click shop and you look at our gear, we want you to love the news that you want to represent us. We have a little sale going on, perfect for summer and patriotism, because we're all about, you know, patriotism without the partisanship, right? We're nonpartisan. So you can check us out there, or you become a Scoop Insider. And that's for the price of a cup of coffee. You join our insider group. And what we do are these live broadcasts together. You get first looks at some of our new gear or first looks at some of our new projects. You get invited to live interviews. For the price of a cup of coffee, it's just a way for you to support us. We don't flood your email with a whole bunch of junk. Junk is the last thing I want to deliver to you. There's enough junk food for the mind in the news. But this is one way you can support us. So check that out as well. You can get that through our website, smarternews.com. Okay, here's a couple quick stories I wanted to race through today. These are top of mind, just conversation starters. This one is from the New York Times. It's an op-ed piece by the Surgeon General. And what it says is why I'm calling for a warning label on social media platforms. In fact, I can go ahead and share my screen with you so you could see this yourself. And make sure to include this in the show notes so you can see it as well if you'd like to read through it. So what is the Surgeon General advocating for? Let me just read you a couple parts of this. This is, quote, "It is time to require a Surgeon General's warning label on social media platforms stating that social media is associated with significant mental health harms for adolescents. A Surgeon General's warning label, which requires congressional action, would regularly remind parents and adolescents that social media has not been proved safe. Evidence from tobacco studies show that warning labels can increase awareness and change behavior." What do you think about this? Do we need a warning label on social media platforms? Do you think that would change anything? Let me go on and read part of this for you. Another quick section of it. He says, quote, "There is no seatbelt for parents to click, no helmet to snap in place, no assurance that trusted experts have investigated and ensured that these platforms are safe for our kids. There are just parents and their children trying to figure it out on their own, pitted against some of the best product engineers and most well-resourced companies in the world." What do you think of that description? Would a warning label by the Surgeon General change behavior? He's arguing in that in some cases it does. For example, you have a warning label on a cigarette pack. Should we do the same thing? Because we're seeing anxiety, mental health issues in children that are connected to social media, or at least it's not, you know, there's the, with science, we have to be very careful. If there's a believed connection, is a cause and effect? Is it a direct cause and effect? These are what the studies are starting to show us. And there's this movement to delay getting kids on social media until they're even out of high school. Don't even give them a smartphone until they're in high school. Don't allow them on social media. This is some of the thinking about it. Give them a flip phone. Doesn't mean they can't have a phone. Just don't give them access to the internet and social media. What do you think about a warning label? Is that something that we need? Would that change behavior? I'll be curious your thoughts on that. That's an interesting topic. Okay, here's a different one. This one is actually coming straight out of New York City. And this is coming from the New York City New York City mayor and the New York governor. Just a reminder, New York City had a 28-month, so 2 years plus, mask mandate on the subways. They were one of the first cities, New York City, to require masking. Obviously, one of the first cities most heavily hit by the COVID-19 pandemic. So now what's happening? The governor is proposing exploring a face mask ban on the subways. Okay, let me read this to you. "New York leaders will explore when to ban New Yorkers from wearing face coverings in the coming months to prevent hate crimes and aid law enforcement, but do not have a timeline to change the law." This is according to Governor Kathy Hochul. "The governor is working with New York City leaders," go on, "to study how to bar New Yorkers from wearing face masks in certain areas after mass subway rioters committed a series of hate crimes targeting Jewish New Yorkers earlier this week." There's obviously a problem here. "This will be dealt with," the governor says. "We will not tolerate individuals using masks to be responsible for criminal or threatening behavior as part of talking about efforts to make New Yorkers feel safer." So this is from Spectrum News. This is a little context that was added. "The state's anti-masking law was first enacted in the 19th century to prevent people from wearing masks, like members of the Ku Klux Klan, and not terrorize private citizens. The policy was repealed during the COVID-19 pandemic." So as you see a lot with protest videos, a lot of folks continue to wear masks. Oftentimes, we're seeing some of these protests in heavily, densely populated urban areas. When you walk some of those urban areas, sometimes people are wearing masks, but we do tend to see that as a trend with protesters. And obviously, New York is also having a problem when it comes to crime and being able to identify suspects. So now, instead of enforcing masks being worn on a subway, they're looking at how do they prevent it? And what does that look like? Just talks about some of the complicated policies that we've seen over the last couple of years. Okay, final story for you, because this is also a conversation starter. We saw a record being set, if you would, or a record concert by George Strait this weekend. It was sort of unexpected. You know, when you think about concerts, so the first thing I think about anyways these days is Taylor Swift, but George Strait, who's in his 70s according to Billboard, broke all of these different attendance records. It's the largest concert ever held in the United States. 110,000 fans, almost 111. We should just give them 111. There has to be an extra 95 people there that snuck in along the way, right? Or who are working that day. Come on. The largest U.S. ticketed show ever at Kyle Field at Texas A&M. Unbelievable. Previously, it was the Grateful Dead who had 107 plus thousand fans at their 1977 show at Raceway Park in New Jersey. But it was George Strait at Texas A&M Kyle Field that now set the new record. I was reading a little bit about George Strait because I was talking about this with a friend of mine. Does everyone know who George Strait is? I feel like everybody knows who George Strait is, but now I live in Texas. George Strait is one of the patron saints of Texas. I mean, he's right up there. He can't, George Strait, you know, take his name in vain. And he's a local, you know, he's from Texas. His dad was a teacher, but also a rancher. So he grew up on a ranch helping out. He's like a legitimate cowboy, you know, it's like he actually wore a hat and boots. But he didn't have it easy. You know, he went to college, actually not too far from where I'm sitting right now, left and actually got into the military. I served in the military for a couple of years in the 1970s, comes out, he still wants to pursue music. But, you know, the people in Nashville were like, yeah, he's okay. True story. I don't know. He was like a little too traditional. And so in 1981, one record, MCA Records, one, you know, big record industry label, said, okay, fine, we're going to give you a one-song contract. That's it. One song. Nothing else. That's all you get. And if it's a hit, we'll see. Well, clearly it was a hit. But that's just a little bit of encouragement. It's a little Monday motivation. I wanted to start with a couple of these quick lighter stories because we had some heavy stuff to get into. Even George Strait was told, no, you're not the right style. And now he set an American record for ticketed attendance in his home state of Texas. So that was pretty cool. I thought that was an awesome thing. Was anyone there? Did anyone go? Barbara saying, the first dance at our wedding was Cross My Heart by King George. See, King George. Barbara, thank you for reminding me of some of these nicknames. So anyways, this is just a reminder to all of us. When we're told no, you never know who also was told no. And here we are. So let's get into some of the bigger stories that we got in front of us. We have a whole bunch of them. I'm actually going to start with the Supreme Court because the Supreme Court gave us a lot of news last week. And we're in this period, just big picture. The Supreme Court, this is their time that they're going to come down with decisions. So earlier this year, late last year, they're hearing cases. But we know in late May, early June, this is when they're going to hand down their decisions about how they felt about these cases. Like, what did they actually decide? And so it's usually a very busy month. Oftentimes, you don't know when they're going to announce which decision when. I mean, typically, you don't know. And in previous years, it could be on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. It seems this year that they're really choosing Thursday and Friday to release their decisions. So know that you may see news from the Supreme Court on these days because, oh, this is when they're clearing their decks. This is when they're putting out the decisions. And this is when the public is finally hearing what they have to say. So last week, we got two big decisions. I'm going to kind of work backwards. So the decision that we got going into the weekend actually has something to do with gun laws. And what you may have heard is something about a bump stock on a gun. What the Supreme Court ruled is that there cannot be a type of rule that was put forward on bump stocks in a gun the way that it was done. And we have to be very careful with the wording from the Supreme Court and what headlines look like, because oftentimes as journalists and media companies, we want to say something sort of broad and sweeping. Supreme Court approves bump stocks, for example, in guns. I'm just making something up. But usually has to do with the way a case is presented. The Supreme Court's full-time job is to enforce and interpret the Constitution. It's about the law. It's very seldom about the thing. And so in this particular case, just to give you a little bit of background, we had the worst shooting in U.S. history, Las Vegas, speaking of concerts, huge music festival. There was someone that opened fire from an elevated position. We still don't know, quite frankly, a lot about this person or his motivations. It remains quite a mystery that's raised a lot of questions, but it led to many, many injuries and dozens of people who were killed. In the aftermath of that, this is during the Trump administration, President Trump says something to the effect that he believes that we should ban bump stocks. What are bump stocks? Let me show you just a graphic that the Associated Press has used. And I thought this was helpful because as someone that does not frequently shoot guns or ever use a bump stock, as many people likely have not, I want to show you what we're talking about. So the thinking behind this quote unquote accessory to a gun, it's something that you can add to the gun that helps you fire more rapidly if you have a semi-automatic rifle. To some, what they were saying is this actually turns your semi-automatic rifle into an automatic weapon like a machine gun. Machine guns are illegal for citizens to possess in America. The military is the only one that has access legally to automatic weapons. So this brushes right up against that. This was the argument. And so President Trump, a Republican, someone who supports the NRA and typically has supported gun ownership, said this is something that this should not be allowed. We should ban this. He did not make that order, but the ATF did. They made a new rule. Bump stocks, not allowed. No longer allowed. You can't have them. And there was a gun store owner, but also a gun owner who challenged this and said, wait a minute, you can't tell me that. I have my Second Amendment rights. This can't happen this particular way. What the Supreme Court did is they actually ruled in favor of the plaintiff, the gun store owner. And what they said was not, hey, bump stocks are great. Everybody should have a bump stock. That's not what they said. What they're saying is that the government overstepped their authority, that the ATF couldn't unilaterally just say, you can't have that for your gun. Sorry, can't do that. Now, if it was gone through Congress, the representatives of the people that are making new legislation, that's a different story. But the Supreme Court said is no, it can't be done this way. You're overstepping. You're overstepping your authority. And therefore, this rule has to be repealed. So you got to be really careful with some of these really sensitive, obviously for obvious reasons, sensitive topics that have a lot of impact, mean a lot to a lot of different people. So this does not mean that this sort of quote unquote accessory to a gun won't be made illegal at some point. What the Supreme Court is saying is that the law that was put in place, should be careful with that. The rule that was put in place is not a law. And therefore the government does not have that unilateral authority to do that. This is a very typical case for the Supreme Court in what I mean in their decision, in the way that they're thinking about something. They're always thinking about, who has standing in a case, who can actually bring a lawsuit or sue someone, who has the authority in this case, where does the law fall? And if the law is the priority for the Supreme Court, they're going to say, well, this, if something needs to be done here in this particular way, it should have been done legislatively rather than administratively. So that's what happened for this particular case. If you have any questions on that, happy to discuss them. I see one of the questions about what sort of gun was used or weapons that were used in this Las Vegas shooting. There's been a lot of questions about this case because I'm always in favor of more questions, which in this day and age, we've been through such a strange historic time where sometimes asking questions, you get punished for it. But there's been a lot of questions about this particular shooting because in many other shootings that are high profile, we have a ton of information. In this particular case, we just don't. We just don't have the information. And there's been a question as to why. I don't have a great explanation for that, but that's where some of those questions are coming from. I want to quickly touch on another Supreme Court case that came up last week that was about birth control. It's not about birth control. It was about what is often referred to as the abortion pill. And in this particular case, there was a challenge to the way that this pill is widely available to the American public. It's often used in abortions. And so the challengers in this case, the prosecution, the plaintiffs were saying, it shouldn't be available this way. It's too risky. They're raising all sorts of questions about this particular pill. And what the Supreme Court said in this particular case, again, wasn't about the merit of the actual prescription drug. It was about whether or not the group that was bringing the case had standing to do so. And what they said is like, hey, this group unanimously, the Supreme Court said, this group does not have standing to bring this case. So we understand this is a challenge to the access over this particular prescription, but you don't have standing to bring this case. So you lose. That does not mean that a future challenge to this prescription medicine couldn't come up. It could come up in a different way, just couldn't come up this way. So again, do you see how those are similarities in those cases? You know, we often attach value to what the Supreme Court is saying about their rulings of saying that they're making a judgment call on, for example, the abortion pill, on, for example, bump stocks and guns, on these particular things. In some cases, they are. But in other cases, they're approaching it from a legal, obviously a legal perspective of saying, hey, can this person actually bring this case? And who has the authority to make the law on this? They're not necessarily looking at the thing, the shiny object that's at the center of the story. So it's a good thing to keep in mind. We do have a big case coming up that we're waiting for, and this is about presidential immunity. And this is the place where the Supreme Court is going to be ruling on the issue. This is their whole job. It's an issue that has to do with constitutionality. And so the government and former President Trump's legal team have both pushed for the Supreme Court to weigh in on this issue. As you know, former President Trump is facing four different cases. We have a conviction in one of them. Two of the cases are federal cases, and they have to do, one of them specifically has to do with actions that he took while in office related to January 6th, before and after. What the president's team is arguing is that the president has some immunity for actions while he took in office, like any president has, because he had to make a certain set of decisions under situations that the average citizen doesn't normally have to deal with. And the Constitution is not explicit about how a president can be prosecuted, if and when a president can be prosecuted. You know, what could that actually look like? And there can be some visceral reaction to this, which is a president just is not a king, and therefore a president can be tried and convicted just like everybody else. That's one argument. The other argument is that sometimes the president is having conversations amongst advisors, let's say about issues of war, about, you know, classified information, scenarios that are not typical, and even in brainstorming the actions that could happen, could they be liable for events that take place afterwards? And as president, would you not make certain decisions that you need to make on behalf of national security and behalf of the American public if you're worried about being sued or convicted of a crime? So this is a really interesting case. Again, sometimes the Supreme Court will look and say, okay, do you have standing? You know, who has the authority in this particular case? And then they're going to look at a case and say, is this case what they call ripe? You know, is it like, should we be weighing in on this now? Has it actually traversed the lower courts? Has there been enough? Has it worked through the system before it got to us? Because you hear sometimes, well, the Supreme Court kicked it back to lower court. In this particular case, like, no, it's ripe. Like the president, who has immunity is really important here. What kind of immunity, if any, does the president have, if at all? And we have cases right in front of us that are trying to go to trial. So this is like what the Supreme Court is made for. This case is ripe. It's ready. The Supreme Court just has to make a decision. And what's really important when you see this headline, because there's going to be all sorts of things about former President Trump, because he's the president at the center of this particular case. But what they say here is really important for the American presidency overall. And that's, we have to keep that in mind. This time period we're in, sometimes it feels like this election period is going to last forever. But what they say on this particular issue can impact the presidency for generations to come. And this is why we're really waiting for that. So could we get a Thursday or Friday of this week? Maybe not. We'll see. And we'll see until the end of June. And so we'll wait and we'll dissect that when we get it. And I'm sure we'll have a lot of different opinions on that. One of the reasons why birth control was on my mind is that I was actually going to talk to you a little bit about what's going on in Congress. The House of Representatives is back in their districts this week. So you're not going to see a lot of action in Washington, D.C., at least from the House of Representatives. We also have a federal holiday, Juneteenth, in the middle of the week. So as far as, you know, seeing a lot of action from lawmakers, we don't expect that necessarily this week. So that's just kind of words to the wise. Sometimes you get a flurry of activity before there's a little bit of a break. One of the things we've been watching in the Senate has to do with these different bills that have been put forward by Democrats. One was on birth control and preserving access, they said, to birth control. Last week, it was about preserving access to IVF. Democrats said that they were really intent on moving this legislation forward because they're worried about different rights and afforded to women in America being stripped back because of changes in the law due to the Supreme Court's recent ruling on Roe v. Wade. Republicans call foul on this. They say, hey, you don't have the votes anyways to advance this legislation because you need 60 votes to advance it. So you would need some Republicans. You know you don't have the votes. You're just putting this topic out there for the media attention. And you know this isn't going to pass. And by the way, we don't like these bills because tucked into them are some other things beyond just the headline. So just know that that's been going on in the Senate. And we're going to see that as well from the House because we're getting closer to Election Day. So you're going to, you know, we always operate from the position. I always operate from the position that people are trying to do the right thing and they're never going to waste our time. And they believe in their hearts and hearts of what they're doing. We're going to keep believing that because we like being optimistic. However, in the world of politics, sometimes things are put forward to push the issue, to force a vote. So then that starts another news cycle of its own when that topic may not necessarily be on the top of mind for the American people. So you have to watch that from Democrats and Republicans both, and especially in this particular season. One of the questions I got a lot on this week was about the draft. And it's probably because you saw something like this. Let me see if I... Do I pull this up? Yep. This is one of the posts. This is from a conservative account on Instagram. They reposted something and it says this: just in, House passes military bill automatically registering men 18 to 26 for draft. This is, and they're citing Fox News. And then the person says war is coming. Okay. When you see something like that, that's going to get your attention. Certainly got my attention. I saw this week and then I got a whole bunch of questions from all of you on social media about this. So what is this about? One of the things that was passed, one of the bills that was passed through the House of Representatives just last week had to do with military funding, defense funding. Very typical job of Congress, right? They have to figure out what is our defense spending for the year. The House is going to come up with their bill. Senate's going to come up with their bill. They're going to get merged eventually so we actually fund our military, but it can be a really rocky process. There was a Democrat that actually put forward this initiative that said that men should be automatically registered for the draft. Now, to understand this, we need to understand current law. And I'm embarrassed to admit this. You know, my husband is a combat veteran. I have two sons. I didn't realize that it's currently law that at between the ages of 18 and until you hit 26, you are supposed to register for the Selective Service. You're supposed to register to be included in a draft. Doesn't mean you're going to be drafted, but that's part of what you're supposed to do by law. In fact, until recently, you couldn't receive a federal student loan unless you did that. And a lot of places, if you're getting your driver's license, it might be a box that you check. It's not necessarily this huge ordeal. It comes up as you reach a certain age. What this lawmaker was saying is, hey, let's make this automatic because someone could face a fine, not know what to face a fine. They could even face jail time if they don't. So let's just make it automatic, which is sort of interesting because you don't automatically get registered to vote, but you could get rid. This is the argument. This is in this particular spending bill, this huge spending bill that has to do with the defense spending. And this is now moving over to the Senate. The Senate, which the majorities are Democrats, don't, very slight majority, the leadership is Democrat, doesn't like this bill. They have their own bill. So whether or not this automatic registration of young men in America for the draft would actually go into effect is TBD. We don't know. It is part of the House bill. And it's also true that you are supposed to do this already. So this would just automatically put you into a database. It's interesting. We have, for historical context for the draft, I don't know how you feel about this, but I think Vietnam is what I usually think about when it comes to the draft. I think about, you know, Forrest Gump. I think about this sort of picture of the reluctant soldier that participated during that time, or that image that's been broadcast about that specific war. But as you know, I was recently in Normandy, and I was so interested to find, because I think about that time period as a very patriotic period where America was behind defeating this enemy in a different way, obviously, than what took place during the Vietnam War. So maybe I thought wrongly that there were more volunteers to serve. But the reality is just under 40% of those Americans that served in World War II volunteered. More than 60% were drafted. And if they're drafted, that doesn't mean they're like bad people trying not to avoid serving. They were just living their lives doing something else. And so I thought that was a really interesting fact about World War II, that more than 60% were drafted. But the image of the person drafted for World War II in Vietnam, you know, separated by just a few decades, is so different. This question about coming conflict, though, I know is one that's top of mind because we're seeing a lot of conflict around the world. And we have a lot of big topics that feel national, because they are national security related. We have Russia with their warships, you know, doing drills in Cuba, that's 90 miles from Key West. It's very close. We have the war in Ukraine. We have the war between Israel and Hamas. There's a lot of conflict. There's a question about a rising, surging China. You know, what does this look like for the security atmosphere in America? And this is fundamentally one of the big questions going into this election cycle, not only for the person running for the White House, but also for our lawmakers as well. So this is a topic that deserves more attention. And I wonder if this particular story would get as much attention if we weren't in this other environment, if it would have just sort of slipped by. It's hard to say because here we are now. All right. Final topic I want to talk to you about, and this one I have a little sound for. This does relate to national security because it's about our border. And we've talked about our border quite a bit. We've seen historic numbers of encounters at the U.S. border. An encounter means that someone came across the border without legal status. Illegally, they came across the border. They were encountered by law enforcement. This person could be a criminal and they were arrested. They could be taken into custody. They could be pursuing asylum. If they're pursuing asylum, then they become an asylum seeker. That is a different category under U.S. law than someone that doesn't have legal status who's in the country. And the volume of people coming across the border in recent years is at levels that we haven't seen in modern data collection going back to the early 1980s. We can say further than that, but when I look at a database, I only get those numbers because we've only tracked it in this particular way for the last four decades. So there was a case out of the state of Maryland, and a case we heard about last summer. Mother was out jogging, mother of five, jogging, walking, hiking. She was on a very popular trail. She was working out by herself. She didn't come home. And her boyfriend alerted police. Right away, people are looking at him, wondering, is he behind all of this? They find her body just a day or so later. And no one knows who did it. You know, there was just a big mystery. So this weekend, we got a surprise press conference from the local sheriff in the area. And I'm going to play about 3 minutes of sound from him because he's going to give you a big overview of the case. And to catch us all up on how this all came together, I thought it was important that you hear from him directly.
3 weeks ago, on May 20th, on what should have been Rachel's 38th birthday, and then a poetic coincidence, or perhaps in Rachel's own divine assistance, our investigators uncovered a lead that led us to this day. And on this day, I'm here to tell you, Rachel's murderer is no longer a free man. The lead we received was related to DNA evidence and allowed investigators to finally put a name to the image of the suspect in the video from Los Angeles, which we released 2 weeks after Rachel's death. After we had the video, we knew what he looked like, but we didn't know who he was. With the new DNA evidence, now we know who he is, but we still didn't know where he was. Police in Tulsa, Oklahoma, assisted by our federal partners, located and arrested Rachel's murderer, Victor Antonio Martinez Hernandez. So far, we have learned that the suspect, now pictured on the screens, is a 23-year-old citizen of El Salvador who illegally crossed the border into the United States in February of 2023. We all suspected that perhaps Rachel was not his first victim. And it's my understanding that this suspect, this monster, fled to the United States illegally after committing the brutal murder of a young woman in El Salvador a month early in January of 2023. Once in our country and likely emboldened by his anonymity, he brutally attacked a 9-year-old girl and her mother during a home invasion in March of 2023 in Los Angeles. And as everyone I believe is aware, that was our first DNA match linking Rachel's case to the Los Angeles case. And I want to now direct these comments to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and to every member in both chambers of Congress. We are 1800 miles away here in Harford County. We are 1800 miles away from the southern border, and the American citizens are not safe because of failed immigration policies. This is the second time in just 2 years that an innocent Harford County woman has lost her life to a criminal in our country illegally. Let me repeat that. 1800 miles from the southern border, and this is the second woman in our county to be killed by an illegal alien. Suspects, in both cases, they are suspects from El Salvador with ties to criminal gangs. Should not be happening. Victor Hernandez did not come here to make a better life for himself or for his family. He came here to escape the crime he committed in El Salvador. He came here and murdered Rachel, and God willing, no one else. But that should have never been allowed to happen.
What I zoned in on was the address to all lawmakers. It wasn't just, you know, he said, obviously, to the president, to the White House, but all lawmakers, like, this is what's happening as far away from the border as where they're standing in Maryland. I want to connect this to another story that we heard over the weekend. It's not directly connected, but when we're looking at issues related to border and security, there, according to reports, were eight individuals with ties to ISIS who were arrested in Philadelphia, New York, and Los Angeles. They apparently came in through some sort of smuggling network related to Turkey. And just on Friday, as we were going into the weekend, Thursday or Friday, the State Department issued a new designation for this terrorist smuggling ring and said, this is what this group is doing in Turkey, administering a route of some sort to those connected to terrorism to enter the United States. So there's all these, there's in this heightened political environment to get a lot of claims thrown out about the U.S. southern border. We know that this is a big issue. We know this is a big political issue. We know it's a national security issue. We know it's an economic issue. We know it's a humanitarian issue. We know all these things. We've talked about the multiple dynamics of this story, but now we're seeing these very real cases connected to border policy. And let me be very clear about something. Stick this in your back pocket because it's important. Republicans had the House and the Senate. They had a majority in these two legislative bodies recently over the last decade. They could have passed immigration or border reform because they had the numbers. They had the numbers. They would say, well, we don't know. They had the numbers. They could have the numbers. If you get the legislation that's pretty much yours, you have the numbers. Democrats had the same. They had the same. Both parties had that. They both had the numbers to do it. They didn't do it. Now they don't have the numbers. Now legislation gets stuck and we're in election year. So everybody's looking at each other wondering, oh, what are we really going to do here? Because we don't want to do too much because, you know, we want to get reelected or we want to do something because we do. And it's not an environment that leads to a lot of compromise. What's interesting too about this particular story about this young woman that was killed, it's very similar, eerily similar to Lakin Riley's case. That was a young nursing student murdered in broad daylight in Georgia, out working out by herself, not in a desolate, you know, there's all these things. Well, a desolate area. Where were they really? No, in all these cases, these were popular paths, middle of the day, and cold-blooded crimes connected directly to people that were coming across the border without legal status that were processed, that the government knew about. So I want to make sure that we're aware of this. We've covered the FBI director saying that he's very concerned about terrorist attacks. We keep these stories, we can only present what's out there. You know, these are the stories that are out there right now. They're just like another fact on the table. And the question becomes, why aren't these stories necessarily getting more attention? And maybe other dynamic, maybe different news cycles, they would. Is it because we're so focused on other things that are happening overseas? Are we focused on our own political environment? Is it easier to look at other things? Is it too hard? Does it feel too big of a problem to solve? What's preventing anyone in government standing up and saying, you know what, for 30 days, let's just shut it down. Let's just shut down the border for 30 days. There'd be legal challenges to that, of course, but let's just take a pause because the numbers are so big And we're on the side of solving this problem, Democrats and Republicans both. You know, where are the creative solutions for this? Or are we just letting the news sort of wash over us and thinking, oh, yeah, it's another bad one? As a journalist, it's always interesting to see which stories ignite and become a new cycle of their own. And, you know, different networks will take hold of different stories. Fox News might take hold of this story. MSNBC might take news of, take kind of hold of like the legislative action regarding IVF or birth control that the Senate is putting through. These are more progressive platforms. You know, you see that happen in the media. We sort of expect that, unfortunately. But this seems bigger than that because it feels like it affects everybody in so many different ways. And I'm a little baffled as to understanding what's going on, you know, why. I haven't necessarily seen this news cycle where you have so many confirmed big stories tying back to a single problem, which is security at the border. But no one seems to be connecting the dots or putting, so I'm very curious your thoughts on it too. Perhaps it's not a priority for you. And that's okay too. You have a lot of things in front of you. But I'm curious about that. I think it's an interest. This, we know that this is the issue that will become a number one issue as we get closer to Election Day. We're going to get, one of the reasons for that too, is we get a report card for the year, the government's fiscal year. And we'll get that right before, which by the way, is not January to December. It's October, you know, is it October to September or September? It's in the middle. It's a fiscal year. And so we'll get those numbers. It'll be highlighted. It'll be millions of people encountered at the U.S. border. We'll see that right before Election Day. So that's coming no matter what. And I'm very curious. I'm very curious what you think about it. Barbara says this. So basically, both sides are using immigration for politics in lieu of serving the American people and those who have legitimate reasons to want to live here. I think it's a great question. Is that actually what's happening? Or are we okay with that? Are we okay with that happening? There's nothing good about anything that's happening at the border. It's not good for the people that really want a chance at asylum. It's definitely not good for them. So this is a big issue for us. And I think it's going to be a big issue this year. Melissa also said this, didn't the government implement an immigration pause in the early 1900s to allow the influx that had come to integrate to American society? That's an interesting question. At a certain point, immigration was slowed down. And especially when it came to World War I, World War II, obviously there's also a lot of suspicion about the European immigrants coming from different countries. What's fascinating about immigration at that time, and we often look to Ellis Island as an example of immigration. Remember, that's legal immigration. That was, you came here and you had to go through a legal process, including a health inspection, to be allowed legally in. So it's not great to compare that to the border where people are coming across without legal status, knowing they don't have legal status, with sometimes the strategy of, I'm going to be encountered by border agents and then I'm going to say I'm applying for asylum. There are legitimate claims. I'm not saying that there's not legitimate claims, but the smuggling network is working that way. So these are different things. The immigration system, though, in the early 1900s, Melissa, it's so fascinating, was actually overseen by the Department of Labor, because the thought was, if we have new people in this country, how do we make them productive American citizens? That will mean if you're a single woman coming off the boat and you don't have anyone that's going to come pick you up, not coming in. They'd send me back. And the reason for that is, what are you going to do for work? You're going to work? Where are you going to work? You're going to work at a bar? What are you going to do? It sounds crazy to us right now, right? This is the sort of interrogation that would happen. Would some man answer for a single woman that maybe she didn't know? Of course there was. But this is how granular we were getting. Oh, you have asthma? You're going to go where? To the Midwest? To work where? No. You can't. Like, there was that sort. This is what I've learned from the historian at Ellis Island. I didn't know that it was that much questioning, but it was, how are we going to make sure when they come in, they're participating in American society and they're being supported? So my great grandmother came through Ellis Island. She came with two children on a boat, you know, very poor, from Northern Italy. In the early 1900s. And she went through Ellis Island and she had to get to San Francisco. If she was going to stay in New York, what they would do is say, oh, you're Italian, you're Northern Italian. We're going to link in your Catholic. Okay. Here's the charity that deals with, oh, you're from Genoa. we're going to give you, this is the charity that you're going to talk to. It wasn't the government social services either. It was, oh, you're Protestant? Here's who you're going to talk to. Oh, you're from Greece? Great. Orthodox? Great. Here's your group. And they would start linking them up with support systems, because why would you want anyone to come into the country and not be supported? Because we know they're going to be a drain on society. They're going to be homeless. They're going to be doing crimes. And we know the people that were born here could be doing that. But we care enough about the labor situation and the economy in America that we want you to be a productive member. Isn't that fascinating? And that wasn't that long ago. You know, we're talking about, like, I think it was overseen by the Department of Labor. I'll have to check my dates on that. You know, it could be 100 years. So really interesting. That historic context, I think, is really, really important. And again, I wouldn't know that if I didn't sit down with the historian at Ellis Island several years ago, actually, when it started Smarter News. Just a real quick anecdote about that. I went to Ellis Island and my computer set up. It was sort of before podcasting. We didn't have the same platforms. I didn't have this microphone, and sat down. We did this amazing interview under this huge, like, glass atrium. There's a library in Ellis Island. It's unbelievable. It's so cool. Just as you would expect, like a movie set. Sat down. We had this great conversation. And at the end of the conversation, like, I closed it and the computer starts pinwheeling. And I thought, that's not good. It's going to be fine. It wasn't fine. I got on the subway. I got, you know, get on the ferry, get to the subway, get back to the hotel, lost the entire interview. But I learned a lot from him sitting there. And then he was gracious enough to do an interview with me on the phone. But that was catastrophic. Anyways, like I said, I like to share these moments with you because it's not easy. You know, just for perspective, I'm going to finish with this one quick thought. And we always think about this, like, what's a choice and what's not? What's, you know, when we're looking to solve problems, what's a choice not to solve it? Or what's a lack of technology, evolution, understanding? Like, maybe we don't have the resources to solve it. So this is, have you guys seen this video? This is from the stadium used by the Colts, the NFL team, football stadium. And in the middle of the Colts stadium, they built an Olympic-sized swimming pool. And this is where the Olympic trials have taken place over this weekend. We saw a lot of swim trials this weekend. And it's just incredible to see. I mean, they built a pool in the middle of a football stadium. And they did so because they knew there's going to be a lot of attention at these Olympic trials, and they knew they were going to get a big crowd. So this also was just coming full circle. Not only George Strait got a record audience, the swimmers got a record audience, albeit a little bit smaller, just over 20,000 people live saw these trials take place. We can build an Olympic-sized swimming pool in a football stadium. And then we're going to turn it back into a football stadium. We're going to build it. And then that's what we can do. We can do that. So if we can do that, let's just play the video again. It's really cool. You think we can figure this other stuff out? Like, I believe in us. I believe that there's a solution there. It's not about resources. It's not about what sort of infrastructure do we put up at the border. You know, there's obviously some really big issues. I don't want to dismiss them, but look at what we're able to do through technology and innovation and creative thinking. We needed a bigger pool, like a bigger area to have these trials. We wanted something sort of high profile, something different. So this is what we did because we wanted to. Just makes you think a little bit, right? So I'll leave you with that thought today. Like, what is a choice? And what is a lack of creativity? You know, do we not have the resources or the will? Are we just choosing that? What is it? Just something to think about today. I think about that too, just in general. You know, when you're looking for a way out of a problem, you think, do I not have the will? Do I not have the resources? Do I not have the creativity? Like, what is it that's preventing us from solving this issue? I guess in my maybe naive thinking, you know, I've covered this border issue now for a long time. And it's taken on a lot of different iterations. But there's no broad policy. And just a quick note, because I heard this weekend on the Sunday shows, you know, there's a lot of talk about bipartisan legislation that was in front of the Senate that would have done some things. Got to be careful with that word about bipartisan. There was a leading Republican that was on a committee with Democrats and an independent that came up with a plan that they thought would be palatable to both parties, and it was not. So it is true. I will call things bipartisan if there's one Republican and one Democrat, but we also need that added context if it's not a huge amount of both, because then, you know, it's I don't want to say less powerful, but it has less momentum. And that's true about this legislation. So Diane says maybe the AI can figure it out. That would be interesting. Anyone want to ask chat GPT? I don't know. What would we get? Maybe that's an experiment. I'd be very curious. Melissa says, I agree. It's fascinating. My father immigrated here in the 1960s and his process was very similar to what I was describing, Melissa, of like getting screened and thinking about like where are you going to fit in American society. Yes. If you guys are interested more in the history on that, we should do a little, that might be a great way for us to approach this topic smarter, good use of our time. And so if you'd like a little bit more on that, I was reaching out to Barry Moreno. He was the historian. I don't know if he's still there. I was reaching out to him during COVID. I wasn't successful, but maybe I can get him back on for an update. So that would be great, or someone like that. Well, thank you so much for today. It's been great to see all of you. I really appreciate it. Thanks for all the support and love of Smarter News. If you're interested in joining Scoop, you can do so just at scoop.smarternews.com. That's a way that you could buy us a cup of coffee once a month so we can continue to do things like this, especially during this important news cycle. And if you're just here just to support Smarter News because that's your bandwidth right now, like, thank you so much, because your time is really valuable. The most valuable resource we have in this world is our time. And I appreciate sharing some of it with you. So thank you so much. I'm going to turn this around, this video around, this audio around for our podcast as well as our YouTube channel. But keep the questions coming. And we have another big week ahead of us. So we'll keep you updated if we see any breaking news items. Until then, all our information is at smarternews.com. Have a great day, you guys. Have a great start to your summer. And I'll see you soon. Bye.
Thank you for believing in quick, concise, nonpartisan, smarter news. Every time you join us or share or save our content, you help us build a solution in news, and we are so grateful. We have a few other ways you can support our mission, from joining our insider community Scoop, to shopping our gear at our Smarter Shop, to just telling a friend. The best way to do any of this is to visit smarternews.com or follow us at Smarter News on social media. Don't worry, we put all of this in the captions so it's easy for you. Plus, we added our email just in case you want to drop us a note. We always love hearing from you. Thank you for helping us deliver news smarter.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.